Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 13th of October, episode 3, and I'm sorry the episodes are a little bit short. What's actually happening is that I'm putting a bit more diction interest into reading. However, that means that I get tired more quickly, so I'm only lasting half an hour, whereas before I was doing marathon efforts up to get to an hour. So that's the way it is, and I'm a bit behind in my New Scientist reading, but it's actually quite an interesting way to approach things. Now, I'm going to vary from the usual by including an advertising feature. We've just nearly finished Ecological Tensions in the Galapagos about these tortoises, which are, I don't know, somehow in conflict with humans, which are on, I bet, the four most viable islands of the 11 islands of the Galapagos, as you find out. And the things about the active breeding programs to bring them back from the brink of extinction generates hotels and developments, which actually sends them towards extinction, that standard sort of angst of being too scientific and too smart, actually killing things in the end. One of the great things was those frogs which suffered a fungal infection, and so people would go carrying a fungal infection into native habitats to check that the infection wasn't there yet, and indeed it wasn't, but a year later it would be, and they'd be scratching their heads, this type of thing. So this is an advertising feature by BAE, some sort of concrete company, BASF, a German engineering company. Oh, I sort of love the German chemical stories, a beautiful legend and a way of thinking things. And there appears to be this most ugly pointy tower in London, it looks like. Gee, London's an awful place to look at. Now, it's Building Better Cities. And obviously, there's no author here because it's by a company. Thanks to ever clever chemistry and innovative engineering, the cities of the future are being fashioned from cleaner, greener concrete. Now, concrete, something I absolutely love. It's sort of like, it's just fantastic. So essentially, you get, I think it's limestone and sand. You heat it up and it forms a calcium oxide, very caustic because the water gets driven away from it, and carbon dioxide gets driven away from it, and sand, so you get the silica, and it reforms a crystal, and the crystals grow, rehydrate, so concrete is hydrated silica calcium oxide salts, and the obviously if I had a whole heap of salt when I crystallize it, it would just flake away. Well, this is slightly different. It's been discovered that the actual crystals grow in a Christmas tree fashion. As the Christmas trees grow up, the salt crystals interlock with each other, forming a big solid mat of crystals, embedding things. Now, it would be interesting to see how they do the chemistry then. So there's so much there about crystallization, when the crystallization sets. Concrete starters, and also concrete flow agents. So you pour concrete in, I suppose you could... I was wondering if you could throw it in pressure or have a... There's so many things to think of. And then you've got to test the concrete and have smarts in the concrete. Now, it's pretty amazing in terms of concrete, building the Hoover Dam. Now, that was one big piece of concrete. Okay, the start of the article. By 2050, the world will be home to 9.6 billion people, and 70% of them will live in cities. Now, the important thing is that... we've reached peak baby, so we know within 70 years from now, I think peak baby, by 2070, the human population will start to dive down again. So we might reach 10 billion, but we'll eventually go down to 8 billion. Okay. Those cities will need to be human-friendly with easy-to-reach workspaces, leisure zones, and make life, urban life, relaxing and enjoyable. Well, it's a bit of a joke if you ask me. Why? Well, no one's never, ever said that for any of the cities. Some of the cities, majority of cities are hellholes, as far as I can see. They will also need to transport the sewage the transport and sewage infrastructure and housing that works for everyone, i.e. it's about concrete. There's going to be lots of concrete. These cities of the future will have to be bigger, better and smarter than anything built before. For sure as. In some ways, they are already under construction. Think of London's Shard Tower. So this is this big, like, shard of glass going up into the sky. And Dubai's Barkhafta, you know, that's the world, it is the world's tallest building. Or even the awe-inspired complexity of hidden structures, such as the Crossrail 42-kilometre web of new rail tunnels under London. London is absolutely amazing. It's absolutely amazing that they've built that. And of course, they're going to do the same for Sydney eventually. All of these are emblematic of the smart city revolution. Oh, well, thanks for that. These are emblematic, but they're not there to be emblematic, I'd say. There's a different way you could express that sentence. At the heart of this change is one of the proverbial building blocks of modern settlements, concrete. The material that these cities will be fashioned from. Beautiful structure. You know, this is the beauty of a corporately written thing as opposed to an individual journalist. Individual journalists get into the set pattern. You read the article and you go, bang, bang, bang. It could be this, could be that. Disagree. No, it's unlikely. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, but if it was likely, it's okay. Blah, blah, blah. Conclusion. No, it's not likely. Blah, blah, blah. But if it was, watch this space. It's really boring to read some of the time. Okay. Clever chemistry is making concrete more advanced than ever. Quote. What? This is really builds it up. I love the way it's built up now. You build it up now, your first quote, which is different from other articles where they quote too early. We can build higher, we can build slimmer, we can build further underground, and we can build for longer. I thought a beautiful thing. That is something, and I don't know whether he would have said that, but it's we can build, we can build, we can build. And it says, Ian Ellis of BASF, one of the world's largest chemical companies. It's not saying this is the article, but this is great. Ellis manages the concrete admixtures technical services that BASF offers in the UK, Ireland and Benelux. So he's a company manager. He said that fantastic stuff. What are you doing there? Ellis, you could be leading the world. Knocked off Donald Trump. Ellis is part of the global BASF team that has developed an array of polymers and associated mixtures capable of changing concrete's properties, increasing its strength. Oh, that would be interesting if it can. Altering its workable lifetime. I wonder what workable lifetime is. It's improving its rheology and even... I wonder what rheology is. And even allowing it for it to spread into newly evacuated earth. Now, that is fantastic. Imagine being able to just dig something. I wonder if you can dig a hole and actually just spray it up. Okay. It's this last property you've been able to spray that allowed the huge cross rail tunnels to be built so quickly and efficiently. Every time the boring machine excavated a meter or so of tunnels, robot sprayed a 400 millimeter layer of concrete onto the newly exposed London clay. As the concrete emerged from the spray nozzle, it mixed with BASF passive accelerator that starts the setting process. Now that's it. You want to actually... Oh, isn't that amazing? So there's an accelerator. So concrete will set at a certain time, but you add different accelerators. And so accelerating setting is crystallization. And crystallization occurs when the stuff begins to absorb water. So it crystallizes, but it hydrates. And you have accelerators, and there's different accelerators you... put in, particularly if depends when you add the concrete. So often when I'm mixing concrete in class, which is difficult, it's a dangerous thing to do. It's what to know what you're doing. You want a fast accelerator so it's set by the end of class time. The issues with fast acceleration is workability and heat. But to the basic things, and so slow is the go. You pour it at the end of a day's work and come back. It's my general thing. And then if you can have fast, well, it depends. You really want either slow setting at the bottom and fast setting at the top, so it all sets in one kick. It's when things set at different rates you get cracks, isn't it? Okay, let's see. Quote, the millisecond the concrete is in the air, it starts to set. Okay, so it's a thousandth of a second travelling. I think that's a little bit too fast, a millisecond. That's concrete is really fast and it's travelling very fast. A thousand metres per second. No, that can't possibly be right. So if it's travelling a metre, I suppose it must be sprayed very close. But say if it went a millisecond would be 1,000 metres per second. So even if it was a foot travelling at a millisecond, because it's the speed of sound is 0.3 metres per millisecond, or 300 metres per second. So there's something wrong with that one. Okay, it says Richard Ford, project manager of BSF's underground construction in the UK and Ireland. This newfound control of the concrete setting time is proving a hit with engineers looking to create what once would have been the impossible builds. Even the process of getting concrete to the construction site has been transformed by chemical intervention. If a check gets snarled in traffic, the concrete might begin to set too early. But polymers need a mixture to prevent this. That's the entire issue, that is your transport time to set time, and you don't want to mix it on site because it's a real deal. Building upwards can create problems too. Much of the concrete poured in the Bo-Kafta, this is the world's tallest building, looks like an eyesore to me, quite honestly. It looks like some kiddies, has to be pumped 600 metres above the ground. By the time it gets up there, it's already more than 1 hour old, you can imagine. And the construction took place in the desert, with the structure exposed to the Dubai's blazing sun. Set. All of this is possible using polymers that helps the particles of cement bind together when it's meant to set, or keep it apart when it's not. But getting the mixture exactly right is a difficult task, you betcha. Be really interesting. It's sort of like if you could have something like a case in a milk where it suddenly gels. This kind of challenge is that Ellis and Ford relish. They liaise with polymer chemists and BSF laboratories around the world to meet the increasingly tough demands for construction engineers. But polymer really doesn't mean it's many units. A mere is a basic unit, and poly means many units. It doesn't say it's chemistry. You can almost say chemical. Tell us what you want the concrete to. I can imagine supercomputers doing this rather well. I did some work on supercomputers. And we'll do our utmost to make it happen, says Alice. Well, that's a guarantee. That's what happens to me. Tell me what you most want in life, and I'll do my utmost for it. It's just, I've got no money and ability to help you. These days, engineers' demands include ecological considerations. Tideway, London's super sewer, oh my god, a 25-kilometre tunnel 60 metres underground, provides a good example. The sewer will directly improve London's environment, reducing sewage dumps into the Thames River by 95%. Well, let's hope they're not dumping too much poo in there. And even materials used to build are arriving on site most environmentally way possible. So, like, that's going to be nothing if there's only 5% going into the Thames anyway. Or if 100% is going into it, it boggles the mind. Oh, poo in the Thames. The other thing is that, like a lot of things, like I think Thailand just puts its poo out to sea. Oh, God. We have to reinvent the way we move and supply concrete, Ford says. BSF was involved in the building of the Queensferry crossing across the River Forth. Also tackled environmental issues. To minimise the project's carbon footprint, the concrete relied on local materials. That in turn meant finding polymer add-ins and other chemical fixes that would transform the properties of those materials, giving the resulting concrete strength, durability and workability. Mm. The technological innovations also help temper the concrete's innate environmental impact, making cement used in concrete involves heating up the ground, minerals at ultra-high temperatures in furnaces to burn fossil fuels and release enormous quantities of carbon dioxide in the greenhouse effect. Cement production is responsible for 8% of the global CO2 emissions, as well as being increasingly expensive. Well, blood oath, 8%. I don't know what, air transport's 4%. So we could just knock off a good old 15% roughly by saying, sit at home and don't have skyscrapers. Okay, that's why BASF's laboratories have developed products that replace much of cement with materials such as limestone filler, fly ash, byproduct, coal fuel power plants, or powered by furnace slag from steel production. I don't think you're ever going to get away from making steel without carbon dioxide. Despite all the challenges facing construction of the 21st century, modern concrete still looks good. It resists attack from pollutants in the air, which you make, and allows construction of eco-efficient, faster, and more cost-efficient. Perhaps excitingly, though, it makes, most excitingly, though, it makes city life better. Okay, and that shows about how polymer can surround the different grains. It's interesting that they're showing the grains with little spikes going up, which is exactly what happens. Little Christmas trees start to grow up. And it's the name of the plasticizer is glenium, super plasticizer molecules that bind to cement grains. So you want it to bind for a certain amount and then give way. I don't know how that would go. My issue is how you can actually change that, like Portland cement. It was about discovery about 18. So you had the Romans discovered concrete, but that involved volcanic ash. Then Portland cement replaced magnesium oxide with calcium oxide of limestone. So you hit limestone and sand together to make Portland cement. Okay, AI fakes its own glorious images of the natural world, in brief. These pictures which look a bit like butterflies, or they are butterflies, and starfish and things. These may look like gorgeous nature photographs, but the scenes they capture don't actually exist. The artificial intelligence dreamed them up. Oh, God. Andrew Brock of Hewlett-Watt University UK and his colleagues at Google's sister firm DeepMind created a generative adversarial network, a GAN. That's interesting. It's also, I'm beginning to learn about more neurons, antagonistic neurons and antagonistic sociology. An algorithm pits two AI against each other to produce new images. Now, this is interesting. That is interesting, and it's also used in maths, simulated annealing, where it finds a solution and you muck it up. You go in and muck up. Here's a few errors. See if you can go back it so it doesn't settles down. The GAN, known as Big GAN, was first trained on thousands of images linked to particular words such as butterfly. Normal systems are only given about 64 images per word, but GAN's massive processing power means it can cope with 2,000. Once trained, Big GAN then created its own images related to the word. A lot of images are photorealistic, and the algorithm has matched to do hundreds of different items. I'm just not really impressed with this. This is Janelle Shane, a researcher who has previously used AI to create the April Fool's pranks. Wow, that's great. Some are good enough to hoodwink even Big GAN's creator. During the project, Brock came across a strip of images of jaguars and bears that Big GAN had generated and mistook it for Google's image search result. Huh. He might be a bit stupid, you never know. However, AI still struggles with some parts of nature. For example, it trips up over the number of legs of a spider and gives them 20 or more in some instances, or adding too many eyes to frogs. Okay, that would seem something rather easy to fix. Now, this is interesting. There's no authors for this. Icy daggers are waiters in parts of Europa. Parts of Europa may be covered with long blades of ice that could make exploring the frigid moon of Jupiter more dangerous. In the driest, coldest places on Earth, sunlight hitting small depressions in the ice and snow can eventually create pointy frozen formation called penites. Penitence. Now, this is interesting occasionally, even in your fridge in an ice cube, you can get a spike going up. And I've seen this only about once or twice in my life. That's an ice cube with a spike going out. So the pressure can go and actually create one of these things. I wonder if this is the case. They can reach meters tall in Europa, which is much colder and much drier than Earth because it has almost no atmosphere. It has even has lower gravity. So Daniel Hobley of Cardiff University, UK, and his colleagues calculated that it could build penites 15 meters high with holes about 7.5 meters across between them. Well, okay. I don't know what the calculation that means. Because penites grow faster when the sun is directly overhead, they most likely appear around the equator, like on Earth. Okay, that's how it's doing proper rotation. Giving the moon a spike belt around its middle. This could be a problem for any spacecraft hoping to land in the region, either because the spikes on the or the gaps between them might trap the spacecraft. You might imagine something getting lodged in there and flopping around, Hobley said. But if you already know how the surface is likely to be spiky and full of holes, you can probably plan around that, he adds. Genius. Amazing how you can get in here, this magazine, with... I'm doing a calculation with less gravity, it goes up taller. But these spikes are really interesting. VR, virtual reality, can ease fear of public speaking. If you're not frightened of virtual reality, think, hate public speaking, practicing up in front of a virtual crowd may help you conquer your fears. It may or may not. I would venture to say, like most things, may or may not. That's a fairly safe thing. It's something which is clearly... A third of people feel excessive anxiety when they have to speak in front of others. Well, that's just a statement out of the blue. Where do you say that? What's excessive? You wait till... So that's a definition. The anxiety that a third of people all feel, that's excessive. Philip Linder at Stockholm University in Sweden and his colleagues wanted to see if virtual reality could provide safe environments in which people can face fears. We recruited 50 adults with public speaking anxiety to try a training app. It works via a VR headset that allows them to pretend they're addressing a large hall of people, a small office meeting, a wedding party. After 3 hours, the participants reported feeling significantly more confident. Okay, I'm just really concerned. There's no controls. There's no... They also felt less nervous, shaky, and sweaty when they were given real-life exercise to take, like asking questions in meetings or giving presentations. With the Journal of Anxiety Disorder, that's really good. You really would like to take cortisone levels and sweat levels. Super Armour helps, and you can imagine that could do a real close thing. You can get then... see what you could start planning to make it, you know, coming closer to keep that sweat level up. I could well imagine. Coelanthants endure. Super Armour helps. Coelanthants endure. I think this is a type of animal, an ancient animal. Okay. The armour of coelanthants has a remarkable structure that may help explain how these fish have dodged extinction for the last hundreds of millions of years. That's right. I think this is one which has just ducked in. I think it's an armed fish. Pretty ugly looking thing. Robert Ritchie of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratories, California, and his colleagues examined coelanth scales and found them surprisingly complex in the structure beneath the tough mineral layer are bundles of collagen in twisted structures similar to spiral staircases. When pressure is applied to scales during a bite, these bundles absorb energy. The team also found fibers between these bundles help stop the spread of cracks in the middle layer. Obviously, do you think they did it with some sort of nuclear, Berkeley Livermore's, some nuclear thing, but we will never know. Okay, Goblin boosts the hunt for Planet X. Okay. I just find that hard to understand, that headline. A dwarf planet called Goblin has been found orbiting the sun beyond Pluto. Oh, so that's within our solar system. Its elongated orbit hints that a long sought after Planet X may also be travelling through the outer reaches of the solar system. So Planet X is a pretty big, it's an actual planet. We haven't seen it yet. The dwarf planet, officially called 2015 TG387, so 2015 is when it's discovered, TG is probably after the discoverer, is about 300 kilometres in diameter and is probably a ball of ice. It was spotted by David Tholon, University of Hawaii, and colleagues at the Super Array Telescope in Hawaii in October 2015, hence its Halloween-themed name. But the International Astronomical Union's Minor Planet Center only recently announced its discovery. The furthest flung part of Goblin's orbit is 2,300 times as far than the sun's Earth is. So that's 2,300 AU, so that's where it incubated belts. What are the two belts? There's the... I have to think, my memory's going. There's two belts. The Oort cloud and the Kuiper belt. So the Oort cloud is a sphere, and the Kuiper belt is not a sphere. Okay. Well, the team found a dwarf planet during a hunt for the hypothetical Planet X, a large planet believed to be at the edge of the solar system. It doesn't say how big the planet is. If such a planet were present, its gravity would tuck the small objects, such as Goblin depicted below, as they passed by, potentially hurling them into a cluster orbiting the sun together. Just like the cluster Goblin was found in. So had they found other planets? What does that mean? The team ran simulations that included super-Earth-like planet in the distant solar system. And found that it would ensure that Goblin stays on a highly elongated orbit. Well, yeah, it's not that good. Found that it's a Goblin, so they didn't disprove Super Earth. Falling rocks create a blast that only nuclear bombs beat. Weird rock falls that can explode more intensely than the most potent conventional bombs are more common than we thought. Such extreme events produce a shockwave that can snap trees growing hundreds of meters away. They're extremely weird phenomena, which have been somehow overlooked, says Fabio Del Basso of the University of Milano Brianza in Italy. The first recorded example took part in Yosemite National Park, California, in 10th of July, 1996. Two large masses of rock fell from a glacier point and plummeted 665 meters. Wow, that is a long distance. Hitting the ground, they released a blast of air that's toppled around 1,000 trees up to half a kilometer away. That was the subject of a study published in 2000, although such events remain a curiosity. Now, Del Basso and his colleagues have identified 21 other extremely energetic rock falls from the past decades, mostly in European Alps and from the Dolomites in Italy. They argue this makes these events less rare than once thought. Well, that's a good thing. They just have to say, I didn't think of it, therefore I didn't think. To cause such shockwaves on the order of 10,000 cubic meters of rock has to fall several hundred meters. The impact is so violent that the rocks are smashed to powder. Typically, they develop in areas where erosion has been quite fast. Well, yes, you'd expect that, otherwise you wouldn't get a rockfall. Based on calculations, Del Basso and his colleagues estimated that just one of these extreme rockfalls can create more than 8 billion joules of energy, more than any non-nuclear bomb. Yes, it's like, what sort of bomb would have to raise it up into the air? And that's, so it's simply the density times the distance times height. Trial drug improves IVF success rates. That's a great thing to know as we go through. People undergoing IVF may soon have a better chance of having a baby thanks to a drug that helps embryos implant in the uterus. In a trial involving almost 800 women, the fertility clinics in Europe, the drug Nolaspion raised IVF success rates. Each participant took a placebo or a Nolaspion pill 4 hours before they had an embryo transferred to the uterus. Oh, it is actually drug Nolaspion. Almost 45% of those on the Nolaspion group went on to have a baby, compared to 33% in the placebo group. What's the number of people in the group? Like, if it's only 10 people, how many people they said? Women. So that's 400. Okay, I don't know whether that's statistically significant. The result represents potentially the biggest advance in IVF in 25 years, said Ernest Lumay at Observer, a firm developing the drug and funded by the research. He says another trial is planned this year and the drug may be available in 2020. Nolaspion blocks the hormone oxytocin. The result is more blood flow to the uterus, which reduces contraction that can affect the implantation, says Lumain. Initial results are promising, but more trials are needed before getting too excited, says Peter Lingworth of IVF Australia. I'd also advise caution until the full experimental details of the latest trial are released. This is the entire thing, getting a corporate person to talk about it. They love talking, they give beautiful press, because they are. Okay, T-Rex wasn't the king of dino brains. Tyrannosaurus Rex may have been one of the biggest and fiercest dinosaurs, but it had a simpler brain than earlier, smaller Tyrannosaur. Martin Kurt of Provo Jeffel, Suffolk University in Slovakia, and his colleagues wanted to know how the Tyrannosaur brains changed as they went from small predators to giants like T-Rex, which could grow to 12 meters. To investigate, they looked at the skull of, at the, so 12 meters, so they're sort of the large of a big truck, but they're not huge like they're in Jurassic Park. They're not like gazillas, are they? Okay. To investigate, they looked at the skull of a 125-year-old fossil. Well, that's before T-Rex, isn't it? A Dilophosaurus, a 1.6-meter Tyrannosaurus that predated T-Rex by 50 million years. Then they did the same to a 67-million-year-old fossil of T-Rex. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. The team found that a shift in the brain's shape as Tyrannosaurus evolved and enlarged from the S-shaped brain of the S-paradoxus to what Connors describes as a simpler, more linear shape of the T-Rex. This is really weird research. Although the T-Rex has a brain 62 times bigger than the T-Paradox, it had a relatively smaller forebrain and midbrain, regions linked with agility. T-Rex also had comparatively smaller eyes and brain regions associated with vision than T-Paradoxes, but it had a larger brain region linked to smell. This is all our view. Research is pretty sort of vague, isn't it? I feel. Some very good article there. Okay, 33. Insight, Energy for AI. Okay, Knowledge Means Power by Michael LePage. Means needs power, but means power. Advances in artificial intelligence could lead to a massive growth in energy use, warns Michael LePage. Okay, he's not going to that crappy way of saying. Artificial intelligence, looks where the first quote comes up. With this first quote, it's fairly set. It's very interesting, like, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and this quote on the fifth paragraph. I'm beginning to notice that. Artificial intelligence breakthroughs have become a regular occurrence in recent years. One of the most impressive achievements so far was 2016, when Google DeepMind's AlphaGo AI beat champion Lee Sedol at one of the world's most complex games, Go. Now, it's one of the things is that, a feat made headlines around the world as an example of machines beating humans, but in a sense it wasn't fair. Sadol's brain would have been consuming 20 watts a pound, with only a fraction of that being used for the games itself. By contrast, AlphaGo was using 5,000 watts all in the brain. It wasn't widely appreciated how incredibly energy-hungry AI is. If you ran AlphaGo non-stop for a year, the electricity bill alone would cost £6,000. That doesn't matter if it's one-off events like the Epic Go Showdown, but it does matter if billions of people want their smartphones to be truly smart, or have their cars drive themselves. Many potential uses of AI simply won't become widespread if they require too much energy. On the flip side, if it uses, in generally, I think when you start off, things like computer programs are really inefficient, and then you can actually watch them over years get more and more efficient and really slick, and then all the architecture goes around it. So, like, I think people are building computers designed around the software, the software needs. That's my overall view. So it really comes down. So you would think people would build computers efficient for AI. Okay. If the uses are so desirable or profitable that people don't care about the costs, it could lead to a surge in electricity consumption and even make it harder to limit warming of the planet. Oh, God. AI, planet warming, AI. It consumes so much energy because the technique behind the recent breakthroughs, deep learning, involves performing ever more computations on ever more data. Quote, the models are getting deeper and getting wider as they use more and more energy to compute, says Max Wellings, the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Take image cognition, for instance. This is done by training neural nets to mimic the brain. You know what I really think is that I think there's going to be a bio brain interface, is my guess. Images are split up and fed into first layer of the net, which is not the internet, but the net of solutions, the neural net, which might look for edges. The result gets passed to the next layer, which might look for simple shapes, such as a dog's tails or a letter or so on. The more you want the net to recognize, the more layers it must have before the complexes it will be. So it's really dumb neurotech. You just reward. So at the moment, a net is a neurocomputer. So you say, recognize edges. Then it recognizes the layers, I would suspect. The more layers it must have before complexity has to identify different breeds of dogs, say, is a much harder task than simply recognizing dogs. The most sophisticated neural nets have grown outrageously large, as a recent paper puts it. Their complexity, there you go. It's a paper I wrote just next to me. I can quote myself. The complexity can be measured by a number of parameters in the net, and some now have more than 100 billion parameters. That gives me a real idea about, there's a problem of readability in a citation. It'd be nice if you could actually mix the two together to say, if I wanted glasses, citation glasses, so you can see the paper. It is important for two reasons, says Welling. First, energy is money. Quote, there's an economic ceiling to what a useful AI technology. What is useful? What is a useful AI technology, he says. For big online services like Facebook and Google, the cost per use of AI has been time, in the regions of thousands of penny. Second, mobile devices can only use so much energy. It's not just about battery life, it's about the limit that comes from ensuring devices don't get hot, Welling says. This is why voice assistants such as Siri or Alexa need an internet connection for full functionality. Your phone or smart speaker doesn't have the processing power needed to run AI locally or the space to store the associated data. All this means that our use of AI can't keep expanding indefinitely unless we reduce the energy requires. What matters is how much. What's really interesting is that fast Fourier transform error filtering, allowing the bandwidth to get down your phone line, is something which is not an AI, but it's still very good, useful. Okay. All this means AI can't keep expanding indefinitely unless we reduce the energy requirements. What matters how much intelligence we can squeeze out per joule, I would say, says William. I would say this one. Take self-driving cars. These require lots of extra systems, cameras to radar that use power and also increase the weight of the drag, further increasing the energy use. But a single largest consumer of energy besides the engine is the processor running the AI. This is why I really quite honestly think you can have self-driving cars. That's stupid. I think self-driving minibuses is what I think, you know, if it's smart enough, it can actually pop around for a few people. I think socialism, that's my view. Don't quote me. Battery buses. According to a study earlier this year, thank you, Michael Lepage. What study? I really need a bit more to be academically strong. Self-driving cars could use up to 20% more energy than conventional cars. That's a big issue for battery-powered cars, limiting the range and increasing the running costs. What's more, the study assumes the AI processor consumes about 200 watts, even though the current prototypes consume in excess of 2,000 watts. For a taxi company using AI directly to replace human drivers, savings in wages would probably far outweigh the higher energy costs, but for the ordinary car owners, this would be a major issue. Therefore, I'd say it's sort of... I don't think anyone's going to own their AI car. Why would you own a driverless car? Because it would just say, bugger off and earn me some cash, you car. I'd do that. And therefore, for it, in terms of, you'd want it to have an ability to carry parcels, weight, carry, I don't know. Okay. Thankfully, people are already working to improve the efficiency of deep learning algorithms by getting rid of unnecessary precision in calculations that greatly increases the processing required. For example, quote, if you use fewer bits, you can train the neural network to get the same results, says Ashvik Bishra of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And I honestly don't think that our concepts of digital may not work so well. Many big tech companies are also developing specialized hardware for running AI. Nvidia, for instance, has produced a chip just for self-driving cars, although the latest version still uses 500 watts. Google, meanwhile, has created what it calls tensor processing units. Now, that is interesting. What is a tensor processing? Tensors are hurting my head. Matrix processing is standard. So, strange that a digit is a tensor, zero rank tensor, two rank tensor, a one rank tensor is a vector, two rank tensor is a matrix, three rank, blah blah. And I think you only get, I think four rank tensor is your special relativity, is your general relativity. Designed to run the TensorFlow machine learning framework, is renting them out for the cloud. I can't see how tensor calculations and neural networks go together. There are more revolutionary designs in the work too. Shunting data back and forth between the memory and processor wastes a great deal of energy, says, So he has developed a chip intended for smartphones that slashes the energy used for 90% by carrying out key operations in the memory itself. That's frightening. If you can do calculations slowly, it's the major thing. The pace of progress is astonishing. The latest version of AlphaGo, called AlphaGo Zero, runs with just four TPUs and consumes around 400 watts. Wow. But these new chips actually bring down the overall energy use of AI. As AI becomes more energy efficient, we will build better systems and use it to do more, meaning there's certainly no net gain. That just hurts my head to hear this. Certainly energy use will keep going up and with more sophisticated AI, says William. In fact, AI is set to play a major part of the world economy. The global spending on AI systems is forecast to reach $60 billion by 2001, according to market research company IDC. Meanwhile, another research company, Gartner, predicts that the value of AI-derived businesses will reach up to $4 trillion by 2022. So I really have to get into AI. My robots are out of date. But we have no idea what this means for the global energy use. It's estimated that by computing, the internet use is about 5% of the electricity globally, and has AI clearly a fraction of this is at the moment. 5% of energy, 6%, 8% concrete, CO2, 4% air travel. Just trying to get this into your heads. And you're using 5% of the energy on your computers. It's just amazing. Not much is known about at this stage. This is Andre of Hawaii Technology, who studies the energy consumption of information technology. But it's very dangerous to say that this is nothing to care about. That's because I'm going to lose my job if you do that. Okay. That's because what matters is not just how much energy AI uses, but also the knock-on effects. To go back to the example of self-driving cars, in theory they could operate in a way that reduces the overall energy use despite their higher energy requirements. For instance, they could line up behind each other to reduce drag and communicate with each other so they don't need to stop at intersections. But most of these savings require a high proportion of the cars on the road to be autonomous. Just as social networks like SafeBus only really take off once people, critical mass of people. Network-dependent effects won't happen in the early phases. I would agree with that, said Zawood at the University of Leeds, UK, who studies transport and energy. People with self-driving cars are likely to commute longer distance because they won't need to focus on the road and can use the time of browsing internet and watching videos. Wood thinks this could double the energy use, but his study doesn't account for the AI part or the massive increase in data traffic these vehicles are expected to generate. In recent years, electricity demand has remained flat despite soaring internet traffic, thanks to a big improvement in efficiency. But Andre thinks we have reached the limits of easy gains in efficiency. If the limit, well, there you go. Have we? No, but Andre thinks. If the amount of data we generate rises without big efficiency gains, information communication technology use could store 20% of all electricity by 2025 and account for a 20th of all carbon emissions. Andre warns this could be a huge problem, he says. Aren't we generating carbon neutral? I'm a bit concerned about that. It's always AI carbon. High cost that makes the worst case scenario unlikely, but Andre's work didn't factor in AI and could even be underestimating data growth, for instance, from lots of AI cards talking to each other. Quote, I think AI will generate even more data than we've seen, end quote, he says. If more data means money, there will be artificial intelligence to make more data, and more data means more electricity. And until our electricity systems are 100% renewable, more electricity means more global warming. And you know what they haven't put in, end quote? Oh no, he's just snuck in there a conclusion, but it sounded like a quote, so I'm not too happy with that. Look, I'm just going to put these two in because I'm expecting a call in a few minutes' time. Thanks a lot for listening as I just push through this article. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.